morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all this morning when you could be outside frolicking. Is that better? Okay. Well, you can be inside frolicking to my talk. Why not? So this is a first of a three-part series that I'm going to give on Buddhism and psychotherapy, which I haven't talked about in quite a while. And I'm talking today. My next two Sundays that I talk probably early in June or late in June, something like that. So, what I'm not going to talk about today is CBT or DBT or ACT or EMDR or hypnotherapy or structural psychotherapy. Just to get that clear. Those are all wonderful, and they derive from the three stems I'm going to talk about, the three stems of psychotherapy. We can talk about those if you'd like to during tea or some other time. But, you know, this would be a 30-session talk. But this morning I'm going to talk about the cognitive component. Really, there are three components in both in psychotherapy and in Buddhism, three stems: cognitive, behavioral, and psychodynamic. Cognitive is really the first two steps of the Eightfold Path: understanding and thinking, understanding and attitude. Second, three parts of the Eightfold Path: speech, action, and livelihood. Behavior, how we behave, right? How we behave. The third one, the meditative component, is really psychodynamic. It involves the psyche. It's the meditative component. Effort, concentration, meditation. So today I'm going to talk about in a very concise way. I'm going to try to be concise because it's hard to do this in 45 minutes or 40 minutes about the thinking component. But let's start about the first two, which is the thinking component, and it's right understanding and right thought, or correct understanding and correct attitude, or sound understanding and sound attitude, the different translations, or sound understanding and sound aspiration. Okay? So, what's the understanding? Basic understanding is the three marks of existence that Buddha talked about. Three marks of existence. First mark is we suffer. We suffer. We suffer as human beings. We suffer when we come in the world. I was present. Watch those kids come out. I know occasionally they don't like that, but mine sure were. We suffer all the way along. We suffer. And furthermore, and that's just inevitable. That's the human situation. But we also, as human beings, suffer about our suffering. We suffer about our suffering. And then we suffer about the fact that we suffer about our suffering. When we get into Zen practice, we're getting really sophisticated, right? We add another layer of suffering, right? Oh, boy. And we suffer. That's the first mark of existence. And we suffer because everything is changing. Everything is changing. I didn't want to come out of that womb in the first place. And here I am. I don't want to go back. Now that I've got it kind of all figured out, but I could be going back at any moment. We suffer because everything is changing. Everything is letting us down because it's changing. It's letting little us down. Second mark of existence. Third mark of his existence, the we, the I, the Tim, the Ben, is a byproduct of the weaving up together of sensation, perception, emotion, and consciousness.
It's a fabrication. It's a fabrication. It's the weaving together of those. And especially, it's consciousness that weaves them together. It's the story that weaves them together. Because we have some desire to move in a continuous way in the world, and when we need to. It's an important fiction. It's a necessary fiction. It's a vitally important, but necessary. But it's a fiction. It's a fiction. So we have the possibility to see through this self-consciousness that doesn't just suffer, but suffers about suffering, and suffers about ad infinitum, suffers about the fact that it's suffering about suffering. Oh, there I'm sitting in my retreat. I thought my retreat was going to be good. But I'm suffering about the fact that my suffering hasn't gotten any better. It's gotten worse, right? So that's self-consciousness. Self-consciousness, which is anatman, anatta, made up, but important, important. We need it. We need boundaries, all of us. So when we have the possibility, according to this practice, to see through this self-consciousness, see beyond this self-consciousness, see around it, and instead of focusing so much on little me, this little fabrication in here that's trying to get everybody to behave, or behave myself, I just see. I just hear. I just feel. So when I see Peter, I am Peter. It's not mystical. It's not mystical. When we see through the screen of thinking, we just see. When the seer and the seen are just the process of seeing, then I am Peter just as much as I am Tim. I am Ben just as much as I am Tim. It's seeing. That's all it is. It's not mystical. Not fancy. Just seeing. Right? I'm Rebecca. I'm Rebecca. No big deal, I am. So, remember the Beatles? I am he, and he is me, and we are all together. I am he, and he is me, and we are all together. I am the walrus. Remember that? Wasn't that when the Beatles got off psychedelics and decided they'd do TM? That he wrote that? I don't know when John Lennon wrote that, but... That's correct understanding. You don't have to take any classes here. That's correct understanding. I am he, and you are me, and we are all together. I am the walrus. I am the duck in the pond. I am the fan turning. When we just see, when we just hear, when we just smell, when we just taste. That's correct understanding in Buddhist thought. And then we begin to let go of our suffering about suffering. We don't need to suffer about our suffering. We just don't need to. And we certainly don't need to suffer about the fact that we suffer about our suffering. We don't need to. But we do it. So our practice is just to see it, just to understand it, just to be with it. And if we do that, we discover this truth, simple truth, which isn't even true. It's just not even true. Just what is. So that's, in a nutshell, correct understanding, right understanding. And what about right thinking, right aspiration? Correct thinking, correct aspiration. Well, once we've done the understanding, even if it's just intellectual, now it's time for us to remind ourselves that we're not just this little talkative, complaining guy in here. People are always dissing, and always dissing himself, right? We're not just this little guy. But we're this great dance of interconnectedness. We're this dance. It's dancing us. It's dancing you guys. It's just this dance.
the understanding. So we're trying to bring our thoughts in accord with this understanding. That's all. That's all there is to it. That's right thinking. That's right thinking. And we remind ourselves over and over again of this, because over and over again we go off. And we just remind ourselves that we can experience, if we come back, an intimacy and joy through just being, through just seeing, through just hearing, and through even just thinking, because we don't just thinking. So I like to quote the Dhammapada a lot. All that we are is a result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with a harmful thought, pain follows him as a wheel follows the ox that draws the carriage. If a man speaks with a positive thought, happiness follows him as the wheel follows the ox that draws the carriage. That's right attitude, right thinking. So trying to base our lives on an understanding of interdependence. Try to base our lives on that. Understanding of undividedness. Understanding that we're part of this continually very sensitized fabric of interconnected change. And try to manifest that through our thinking and our lives. Try to manifest that as much as possible. Use lots of teaching to do that. Lots of books if you want books. Or no books. Just play the Beatles. Just play I Am the Walrus over and over again. If that helps you, just play that over and over again. So that's... And I did each for five, 5 minutes of each. That's right thinking. That's right understanding and right thinking. Now I'm going to get into cognitive therapy, which I'm going to try to do in about 8 to 9 minutes. I didn't time it, but we'll see. Cognitive therapy. Cognitive therapy, when I was at Stanford, I'm an old guy, and I went to Stanford when I was a young guy, and I studied Albert Ellis, rational emotive therapy, which morphed into cognitive therapy. Actually, at the time, I thought it was kind of dumb. I was not into it at all. I was into Zen sitting. I thought, this is superficial. But anyway, I'm not going to get into that because I'm doing right thinking today. Albert Ellis, rational emotive therapy. And then Aaron Beck came along. Aaron, you can look this stuff up. You know, you look up everything online now. Sometimes I look stuff online just to see if my memory is right. And often it's not. But in this case, actually it is, because I learned this stuff when I was young. Stuff I learned when I was young sticks with me more. You know that? Well, you guys are too young to know that. So, rational emotive therapy turning into cognitive therapy. And then Aaron Beck. And then David Burns, feeling good, cognitive therapy. And then from there on, that's about 1990. For the last 25 years, cognitive therapy has been just accepted as a main way of doing psychotherapy, accepted. And in 2013, Aaron Beck and the Dalai Lama sat down together and had a wonderful chat, which I read about it online. You could probably even see it online. I didn't see it. A chat about this. Because I always thought, well, these guys must have known about Eastern thought to do this, because it's so in core with what we do. But then when I saw Aaron Beck and the Dalai Lama together, I thought, oh, yeah. And I realized that Aaron Beck had been exposed to Eastern thinking when he was a young man. And so there you go. So cognitive therapy. Suffering is due to thoughts that are harmful. Suffering is due to thoughts that are harmful. And thoughts that are harmful create cognitive distortions. The mind convinces us of something that isn't really true. And we reinforce this negative thinking or emotion by telling ourselves things that sound rational and accurate.
but really only serve to keep us feeling bad about ourselves. Bad about ourselves. Anybody ever had this experience? Anybody? Anybody? Anybody not had this experience? I don't think so. I say, if you haven't had it, you should become my teacher, but I don't want you as my teacher if you've never had this experience, because you're going to be a fake teacher. I don't need any fake teachers. So, cognitive therapy can be important, whether we just read a book about it, or go online, or just think a little bit about it, because we have to feel good enough about ourselves to wholeheartedly walk on the Buddhist path. And if we get stuck on cognitive distortions, we just want to quit, which happens lots of times. But when that happens, usually there's a cognitive distortion going on. So it can help. It can help. I guarantee you. I guarantee you. So, seeing our cognitive distortions can help us discover that what we see is what we are, that what we hear is what we are, and stop suffering about suffering. So now I'm going to talk about 8 cognitive distortions. Now there, you could find some therapists have 20 cognitive distortions, some have 18, some have 32, some have 6. I'm doing 8. I'm doing 8. And actually, I put these 8 are in my book. In my book, Nothing Holy. But I don't say anything about psychology in my book. I just stick them in there. First one is all or nothing thinking. Black and white thinking. For example, if I don't give a talk that everybody likes, I'm a failure. If one of you even looks like you're sleeping, right? All or nothing thinking. Black and white, black and white. My friend said to me, I've totally failed. I can never lose weight. I can never lose weight. So she was upset her so much that she had to have a whole thing of ice cream, right? My house is a mess. We have relatives staying with us now. A lot of relatives. My house is a mess. Oh, well, we only have 2 relatives, but that seems like a lot. If you know what I mean, maybe you don't know what I mean. We have 2 a lot of relatives. They're living with us for a while. My house is a mess. I'm a total slob. I don't want Ben to come see my house. I'm supposed to be practicing Zen. Just take care of everything. I'm a total slob. So I reframe that. Given that I've got these guests, how busy I was last week, it's amazing that I managed to get the dishes done. We reframe. We reframe it. There's something that isn't etched in stone, that isn't all or nothing. All or nothing thinking, number one. Number two, always or never thinking. We have 2 or 3 negative experiences, and then we say to finding a romantic partner, making it work, and we say to ourselves, I'll never find a life partner to love me. I'm not lovable. I'm not lovable. Situational depression. One of our relatives has a great illness, and we're depressed. We have great illness and we're depressed. We say, I'll never get better. Always or never thinking. Remind ourselves that because an experience is unpleasant or doesn't live up to our expectations, doesn't mean it will always be like that. Remember the second mark of existence? Everything's changing. Everything's changing. Third, mental filter. Sounds Zen, doesn't it? Mental filter. We pick out a single negative detail and dwell on it. 2 of you fell asleep in the back room during my sitting. I noticed you, and I dwelled on it all week. I wasn't this, I wasn't that, I should have been this, I should have been that, I might have been this, Oh, my students are better than me. Oh, nobody falls asleep on them. Oh, oh. Right? Oh, oh. Yes, yes. Mental filters. Pick out a single negative detail and you obsess. Suffer about your suffering for a whole week. You don't want to give any more talks again or something, right? Fourth, mind reading. Mind reading. Ah. Yeah, she looked at me funny. She doesn't like me. I'm staying away from her next time during coffee. Well, she looked at me funny. Maybe she had, was just kind of tired or was, in some kind of a state herself. But why is it me? Mind reading. We go around mind reading all the time. Right? And then we think, oh, this is Zen is really about mind reading. It's not. I can't read minds at all, you guys. I can barely even remember what I agreed to do with my wife. It was all spelled out. Totally spelled out. Labeling people as intelligent, as dumb, as responsible, as irresponsible, as competent, as incompetent. So the problem there is that we're overgeneralizing. Remember, no one's just one thing. Remember the three marks of existence? No one's just one thing. We're overgeneralizing. So when we do that, we're saying the person's character or essence is that they're intelligent. Then they think, oh, my character essence is that I'm intelligent. Then they have to live up to that. Or it's something. So when I first learned the nested eating bowls that we have here, the Oryoki, I could not do them well. And I started to say to myself, I'm incompetent. And plus, this is stupid. I'm incompetent, but they're stupid that they have us do this stuff. Not America. It's un-American. But I'm labeling. Instead, I stuck with it. Gradually, this is hard to learn. I'll keep at it. My daughter always corrects me about this labeling because she thinks that I'm supposed to be the Zen teacher. She read my book. She liked my book. So now she's on my case even more since she read my book. So my grandsons have a very limited range of food they like to eat. A very limited. And the two of them like different foods. There is not any, they don't seem to share any, except for pizza. The only thing that they'll both eat together is pizza. So, they would have pizza, lunch, breakfast, lunch, and dinner would be fine. So I said, these boys are picky eaters. And Aaron said, no, Dad, they're not picky eaters. You're the Zen teacher. Don't give them that label. You box them into that label, and it's not healthy for them, it's not healthy for me, and it's not healthy for you. Okay. 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 We all need reminders, don't we? We all need reminders. Picky eaters don't exist. Remember the three marks of existence? Picky eaters don't exist. There are particular behavior patterns that we have. We like certain foods, don't like certain foods. Sometimes we do well on tests and people think we're intelligent. Well, we did very well on that test. Very well on a series, maybe a multiplicity of tests. The sixth one, disqualifying the positive. She only called me because she felt obligated to, not because she wants to continue our friendship. Disqualifying the positive. Anybody done that? Magnifying, number seven. Magnifying. We magnify the experience and convince ourselves that this is the new normal. So
I have Lyme's disease. I seem to have it permanently, although I'm told everything changes, so it should be going away soon. I've been telling it that for 6 years. And so I was sick with Lyme's disease, down for 6 weeks. And then about the fifth week, I'm starting to magnify my experience of the last 5 weeks and thinking, oh, this is the new normal. I might not get better. I told a couple of people, this may be the new normal. I'm not going to get better. But I was magnifying, because actually, if you look back at the last year, most of last year I've been pretty healthy. But we take a negative experience, we glom onto it, and we magnify it. We magnify it. The last one. I saved this one to last because it's the one that actually I deal with the most with people that I have one-to-ones with for the last 12, 14 years. This is the one the most. Not that they'll say it to me, but that I'll see it in should statements, making should statements. We try to... Now, that's not to say that should is not necessary. It is necessary, but we sure overdo it. We try to motivate ourselves and push ourselves into shape. And then we set ourselves up for negative self-judgment and self-blame. I should be doing meditation every day. I don't want to come see Tim until I start doing it every day again. I don't want to see Ben until I at least start doing it every other day. I should be doing it. I should be good. I should be this. I should be that. And then we feel guilty, as if we deserve punishment. When what we truly deserve is compassion for having set impossible standards, as we as human beings do. We're always setting impossible standards. So I have ordained about, 6, 8, 10 people over the years. I mean, I could add it up. I don't know. Maybe 8 people over the years. And I'm ordaining more to be Zen priests. And what I most want to pay attention to is are they getting into a should mode? Are they restricting themselves and constricting themselves into a should mode so they're no longer alive? So much religion is based on should. Be careful. This should one, it seems to be almost the core of religion, but it's not the core of Buddhist openness. On the contrary. Buddhist openness doesn't know anything about Buddhism. Not shooting. Well, these are cognitive distortions, and therapists try and help a person learn to correctly identify them and change them, as I did when I was a therapist. And they're referred to in therapeutic vernacular as stinking thinking. Wow, stinking thinking. And when therapists get together to do group consultation, they talk about the stinking thinking of their clients. They're not allowed to identify their clients. We can never identify them, but we can talk about their stinking thinking. We don't talk about it. Oh, yes, and then when you get supervision, your supervisor will help you talk about your stinking thinking. But I won't get into that right now. By refuting the negative thinking over and over, it will slowly diminish and be automatically replaced by balanced thinking. So the therapist offers a roadmap to understand internal reality, identifies areas of distress, and selects appropriate interventions. Okay, that's in sync with this. All is in sync with Buddhist practice. Katagiri, the founding teacher here, used to talk in his talks about stinky Katagiri. The little guy inside here. Stinky. See the little guy. See the little girl. Stinky. Bhante Gunaratana, the Buddhist teacher, says, your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels. Stinky. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels. Then he says, no problem. No problem. Where's the problem? Just, we don't need to suffer about that suffering. We can just be with it. No problem. No problem. And so, you know, of course, Buddhist practice, we take cognitive therapy one step further by saying every cognition, if we cling to it, is a distortion. Every cognition is a distortion. Each opinion that we are wedded to causes pain, causes suffering. And as much as possible through our practice, we can open up beyond the small self to, I am the walrus. I am the pigeon. Just that. Just that. So the key components to transforming our attitude, to changing our thinking, are openness. Openness. Not I'm going to perfect myself through the zazen and make a perfect personality and a perfect body and a perfect mind, but discovering what's going on, what the cognitive knot is, and just opening. Just opening. And this requires willingness to work. It requires effort. Total power. Continual effort. Continual effort. Total power. And it requires, well, it requires in our total power, the willingness to come back to the understanding that we're all in this together. Anytime we have a negative thought that we're caught on, just come back to that simple understanding that we're all in this together. And if we do that, then we can really evoke some loving thoughts. Some loving thoughts. We just evoke those. And we have to kind of fake it for a while because we don't feel it. But we can do that. We can do that. So St. Francis de Sales says, a cup of knowledge, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience. That's what it takes. Sometimes you'll be meditating, and it'll nourish you a lot. You're sitting, and you'll feel rested. Other times you'll sit after a busy day, and your body will be tight, and your mind will be spinning, and you'll be hating. Total power. Just take one step. Just take another step. You're A-OK. You're grounded in the earth. Just do it. Just do it. A cup of knowledge, a barrel of love, and an ocean of patience. An ocean of patience. So here's a poem by Gary Snyder called The Avocado. The Dharma is like an avocado. Some parts of it so ripe you can't believe it's so good, and other parts hard and green without much flavor, pleasing those who like their eggs well cooked. And the skin is thin. The great big skin around the middle is your own original true nature, pure and smooth. Almost nobody splits it open or ever tries to see it if it will grow. Hard and slippery, it looks like you should plant it, but then it shoots through the fingers and gets away. So I was a kid growing up in California. My mother taught us to plant our avocado seeds in the house, and she taught us how to put them in a little glass jar. And you know, you have to turn it the right side up so the roots will not grow up, and then put three or four toothpicks under it to anchor it so it doesn't get totally submerged in the water. I don't know. Well, maybe you don't do this in Minnesota. But we don't. Probably you don't. And then water it every day, clean the water, take care of the water. And then, you know, the roots start coming into the bottle. My mother was into this stuff. And so we got into it. You know, often you get into it until you become an adolescent. You're really into what your mom is into. Then when you become an adolescent, no way, Jose. So, you know, we get up to 6-inch stem and roots. Then we plant it outside. And you have to wait till after the last frost, which is February 1. The last frost on February 1, and we would plant it the first week of February and watch it grow, take care of it. My mother would always say, you know, you've got to water it every day, Tim, if you want it to thrive, if you want to have like an avocado. Well, we never got any avocados because I only watered them intermittently, but I had an aspiration to water it every day until I became an adolescent. Then I thought I was just stupid. So we need to water this understanding that we're all connected, that I am Ben, that Peter is me. We need to water this understanding with our meditation. We need to give it plant food. We need to get nourishment from the Sangha, giving each other support, coming together, listening to the Dharma, getting the Dharma in us, discussing it, getting extra nutrients. We know a lot of nutrients to grow, a lot of nutrients. And sometimes, of course, we'll get impatient. The retreat was painful. Yes, it was painful. I understand. Yes, you suffered about your suffering. Yes, you suffered about your suffering about your suffering. Yes, yes. Have to be willing to feel the pain, to feel the joy, to feel the pleasure, to feel the hot, to feel the cold, the whole thing. Total practice. We can't open our heart to pleasure and not feel pain. We can't. We can't. So openness and effort. When we see we're caught, we just bring ourselves back to the quiet center. When we notice that our thinking is not based on we're all in this together, we send loving thoughts to ourselves or to the person we're pissed at. Doesn't mean we aren't straight with them. We're still straight with them. We're still straight. You have to be straight. It's important. So this is not. I wasn't sure if I'd have time to tell stories, but I have a little bit of time. So I visited my grandsons in France, and we went to McDonald's. Their mother will never take them to McDonald's, and there is a McDonald's in Paris, but that McDonald's is not garish like ours. You know, it's done in the French way. On the outside, you can't. There's nothing flashy, but you go inside. And it's the whole deal. So my grandsons never got to go to McDonald's. Because my wife and me, we're not into McDonald's. My daughter's not into it because we're not into this fast food instant gratification thing, right? And it's not healthy. But Logan has decided his birthday party, which is May 30th, is going to be at a McDonald's. They have a room there for birthday parties, and they hardly charge you anything, and that's, you know why, they're good marketers. So we went over to McDonald's in the middle of Paris, and Logan was so excited, and he said, Mom, I get to have a Coke on my birthday. She said, yes, you get to have, he's never had a Coke before, yes, you get to have a Coke on your birthday. She said, Mom, they produce that food right away. They give you those big hamburgers right away. You always have to work for 2 hours in the kitchen. I'm hungry. I like this place. Can't we come here all the time? And Heron said, I told you, we're doing this for your birthday. It's a special treat. Look. So we want instant gratification. You hear me talk. You want it. Of course you do. You're suffering. Of course you do. But this is not instant gratification. Learning about your cognitive patterns through your meditation practice and with a therapist if you want one, if it's helpful to you, and allowing them to be until they release might be the longest thing that you'll ever do. It might be. It might be. But that's fine. The turtle doesn't mind. The turtle just does it. Just does it. You want to be a hare. Oh, you want to be a hare. You want to get to the finish line. But our right attitude is to just notice our all or nothing thinking, our always and never thinking, our labeling, our shoulding, our personalizing, our magnifying, our disqualifying, the positive, our mind reading, or whatever it is our mind is gyrating about, obsessing about. And if we're going to do cognitive therapy thing, we challenge it and we reframe it.
I gave you examples of challenging and reframing. And if we're going to do just the Shikantaza thing, we let it go. And if it won't go, we just let it be. Our turtle practice, we just let it be. And it diffuses itself if you let it, if you just are there with it. It just diffuses itself.
So there's a Sufi saying, overcome any bitterness that may have come because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you.
You've been entrusted to a magnitude of pain, most of you. If you haven't yet, you will be. You'll be entrusted to a magnitude of pain beyond what you ever expected or ever wanted. You saw it in someone else, but you didn't really experience it till now. But it's possible to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. In joy. Not fancy joy, just, oh, wow, here it is. Here it is. It's not different for me. It's just my life. Just my life. So in the middle of our suffering, in the middle of our awful suffering, we have the capacity to love. And really, that's all I Am the Walrus is saying. That's all it's saying. We have the capacity to love. That's all of these books about Buddhism are saying. You have the capacity to love because you're interdependent with everything. Duh. It's just loving yourself. I'm just loving Peter as myself. I have the capacity to do that. Even if Peter did something really mean to me, like, I don't know him well enough to know what mean he might do to me. I have the capacity. We have the capacity.
So in Buddhist teaching, we start the path with understanding and thought, and then we do all our practice, go through the higher path, all the path, all the steps, and then we end up with understanding and thought. The understanding that we're all in this together, which has been just cognitive, gets in our body, gets in our consciousness. So the avocado splits open. We don't want the avocado seed to split open. It's painful for the avocados. I don't want it split open. I want to grow roots and stem without splitting open. You have to split open if you're going to grow into understanding and thought that includes all life. You split open. You split open. Grow into a tree. But only with turtle practice. Hair practice, it doesn't happen. Well, there's exceptions, I'm sure, but I never met anybody. Maybe you did. So, in the Buddhist thought, understanding and thought, right understanding and right thought, are called faith or trust until we do the whole path. Then they're called, and we do the whole path over and over again. Then, understanding and thought are referred to as prajna, as wisdom. Just happens. But it's not that I think I'm wise. If you think you're wise, you're way off course. Oh. I'm as wise as Peter's wise. I'm as wise as the clock is wise. Yeah, I'm wise. The clock, Peter, and I are both really sagacious. We're great sages.
So we discover that we're in love with everything. We just discover we're in love with everything.
Beyond self-consciousness. Not dissing self-consciousness, but seeing self-consciousness, opening into self-consciousness, and letting the avocado seed split so we can grow a healthy plant. So I think that's what I want to say. So, and I did it in the requisite amount of time, so... You guys should all be proud of me. I'm proud of you. You should be proud of me. I should be proud of you. See how innate this is? How innate this shoulding is? Interesting, huh? And of course, we do need it. I mean, that's a whole other talk. We need the shoulding. I watch how my grandsons need to develop superego, need to develop conscience and superego. But I don't know. That's another hour talk. Okay. Questions? Comments? Who would like to say something or ask something? Who would like to say something or ask something? Yeah.
Why is it easier to be the cognitive? What did you call them?
Pardon?
What did you call the cognitive?
Cognitive distortions.
Yeah, why is it easier to see the cognitive distortions than other people?
What if you see the cognitive distortions in other people? Yeah, well.
Why is it easier to see cognitive distortions in other people than it is to see them?
Why do you think it's easier to see cognitive distortions in other people? Do you have any sense about that than yourself? Her question was, why is it easier to see cognitive distortions in Ben than it is for Tim to see them in himself? Why is that easier? Do you want to conjecture or not?
Then I can blame Ben.
Well, that's pretty good. He deserves a lot of blame. Well, we objectify. We project and we objectify. We don't want to see this stuff in ourselves. We project, and then it's less painful for me when I can project it on him, when I say it's his thing. It's his thing, not mine. And I objectify him, I project on him, and we do that all the time. We're continually doing that. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I think it's like you said with your Oreo-yoki example. You couldn't get it, and it was stupid anyway.
Pardon?
You couldn't figure out how to do Oreo-yoki at first, but it was stupid anyway.
Yeah.
Projection.
Yeah, that's right. Projection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's my third talk on psychodynamic therapy, whenever that's going to be. Projection. But these all come together, you know. And a good therapist, a good 21st century therapist, should be schooled in all three of these, and we'll mix them up. I will say that as Americans, we don't seem to have time for psychodynamic therapy anymore. There's no time. We're hares. And cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy we have time for, but not psychodynamic. We're hares. We just want to live at McDonald's all the time. Yeah.
As you were talking, I kept thinking about the immigrant situation. People who have been in Somalia. People who have been in war-torn situations. How there's such, in your abandonment, such this feeling of not accepting.
Yes.
Not taking. And if we're the walrus, we're all.
Yes. Each the struggle of each immigrant at this moment, each of those Syrian immigrants is my struggle. It's my struggle. Mm-hmm. And I have the capacity to see that as my struggle and do what I can to help. And it's not overwhelming because I just see it and do it. Yes. Did you guys hear her question? Yeah. Someone else there standing up in the back? Oh, no.
Comments about a mindfulness-based therapy.
Mindfulness-based therapy, I will save more for the third talk, But you do need to be mindful to do exactly what I've been talking about today. You need mindful in terms of just paying attention. Just paying attention. So that you can see whatever distortion you're doing and either challenge it or let go of it. So if you're not mindful, you can't do it. You can't do it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah.
How can you apply recognizing cognitive distortions into your actual sitting practice?
So his question is, how can you apply cognitive distortions into your sitting practice? Well, I'm a Zen teacher, so I'm not going to do any program about this. I'm not even going to suggest that you think about these six or eight while you're sitting. Because as a Zen teacher, I'm concerned that your mind will get all glommed up with, you know, I'm doing one of these, I'm doing this, I shouldn't be doing it. But you notice in your sitting when you're obsessing on something, when something keeps coming up. That's a distortion. And what you can do is you can come back to your breathing. You can come back to the sensations in your body that you're feeling. Usually this obsession is related to some emotions, and that emotion is there in your body someplace. You can come back to your breathing. You can come back to your immediate sensations. You can do a number of things just to bring yourself back and not to be carried away by that obsession, that little cognitive distortion that's going on. And sometimes you just need to let it be. You just need to let it be, but you don't water it. You don't give it any plant food. And if you notice in your water, you're watering it, you stop watering it. You just stay open. Just stay open. As much as you can. And this is turtle practice, so you might just close down and piss and moan to yourself. And that's okay. This is turtle practice. That's no problem. That's no problem. One last one. Okay, well, thank you very much.